Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889, and by French Market Coffee, locally roasted in New Orleans for 125 years. WWNO New Orleans and our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Over the last decade, the state of Louisiana has become a real beer lover's destination. New breweries, large and small, are proliferating the state, using inventive ingredients in their brewing that result in surprising and challenging new flavors from an age-old process. The undisputed leader of our local craft beer revolution is Polly Watts, owner of the Avenue Pub. Polly has encouraged and supported new U.S. breweries, all the while importing rare and unusual brews from across the world. You see, the Avenue Pub is so much more than just a beer joint. It's a place where aficionados gather for real taste education. To ensure the pub's instructors, also known as bartenders, are equipped for the job, Polly took the whole team on the trip of a lifetime to Belgium, where they drank in the knowledge along with a delicious beer, returning as some of the most educated tapmeisters in the state. After we return from our vicarious trip to Belgium, we'll visit with Brooklyn Brewery chef Andrew Gerson. He travels the world with the Brooklyn Brewery team, producing international food and beer pairing events. Wait till you hear where beer has taken Andrew. And then, right here in New Orleans, we'll visit Courtyard Brewery, where Scott Wood brews some of the smallest batches of beer commercially made and sold. How would you feel about a district donut brew? We'll see on this week's Louisiana Eats.
I'm Polly Watts. I'm the owner of the Avenue Pub in New Orleans, Louisiana.
And I'm Alfred Flanagan. I've been bartending at the pub for a little over a decade now.
I'm Eileen Matuszewski, and I'm one of the managers at the Avenue Pub.
Polly Watts and her team of craft beer buffs would sooner replace their Berliner Weiss with Bud Light than close their 24-hour pub for more than a day. That is, until taking a staff trip to Belgium became a possibility. Polly planned a tour of some of the most legendary breweries across Belgium, and her team got the opportunity to meet several of the brewers whose very special beers grace the Avenue Pub's extensive menu. Following their return to New Orleans, we sat down with the Avenue Pub crew to hear about their travels. To begin, Polly described how this beer lover's dream became a reality.
Well, I'd been to Europe for a few times on beer-related visits, and I had been scheming for a while on how to get major members of my staff over there. And in the long run, we just decided that it was easier to close the bar and then just take as many people as we could. And then we wouldn't have to worry about what was going on at the bar while we were over in Europe drinking beer and having fun.
And this was an enormous step because the Avenue Pub operates pretty much 24 hours a day.
Pretty much.
365 days a year.
Yeah, the last hurricane, we got called out by the police chief on television. So we kind of had to close because he called us out by name during his press conference. So we had to close. But as a general rule, we close for about 36 hours after Mardi Gras Day on Ash Wednesday. We're still in there working and cleaning up, but we're closed for business. And other than that, and Katrina, the closure after Katrina, which was fairly short by most people's standards, yeah, we don't close.
So how many people went along on this beer journey?
We had 9 staff members go.
And where did you go?
We based out of Brussels. So we rented a house for the whole staff, for the staff that went in Brussels. And we rented cars and we did the breweries in Brussels. And then we went out in the countryside and to other cities. And we also fit in Cologne. Because it's only about 2 hours from Brussels.
Well, tell me about the activities. Tell me what you all did and what you learned when you were there.
So on Monday, we did Brussels. So we were at Cantillon and De La Seine Brewery. And Tuesday, we drove to Ypres, or Ypres, depending on whether you do the Dutch or French translation, and went to Van Eck, which is the brewery that actually makes the pub pills for us. So we spent the day there, and we did a bunch of World War I things in addition to the beer tours, and had a phenomenal lunch in a Michelin restaurant.
Watou, Belgium.
In Watou, yeah. Oh. 1,500 people live in Watou, and they have a Michelin-rated restaurant.
Oh, my gosh. It must have been delicious.
It was fantastic.
When you all arrived in Europe, what was the first beer you drank?
Do you remember this when we were at lunch?
Yeah. So there are 2 versions of their story. There's the version I'd like people to think, and then there's the truth. The truth is that we arrived, we had no luggage, and we sort of had to kind of stay close to the house to see if we were going to, but we were all itching to get out and get something. So we walk out, several of us walk out. And we stop in a cafe, and they have the worst beer imaginable. So we're sitting at the cafe, and we just are soaking in the fact that we're in Brussels, and, you know, any beer is great because you're in Belgium, except that's not really the case.
But our second beer.
The second beer was really awesome.
That was De La Seine. So Yvonne DeBetz from De La Seine brought a care package to the house, and not only did he bring us beer,
Four cases.
He brought us proper glassware to drink said beer in.
Well, let's walk through some of the new tastes that you all had. What were some of the surprising experiences and things that you learned?
I don't know if we really tasted that much new stuff, because Polly is pretty good about letting us try most of the beers that we have there. Just, it makes it easier for us to describe it to a guest. It makes it easier for us to sell it. So a lot of the stuff we had already had. We did go to Cantillon, and Jean brought us out some beers that we hadn't had before that I don't think are distributed to the U.S.
No, they're not distributed to the U.S. He brought out some stuff from his personal collection. So he introduces me to this beer, and he says, "This is the best lambic I've ever made." And that's a lot coming from that man. And I said, "Well, okay, I want to taste that." And he said, "Okay, well, maybe it's not the, you know." Then he started hedging, I think, and realized how highly he'd praised it and got a little modest. Lambic is a very traditionally made beer.
Yeah.
And most aficionados feel that it has to be made in the Seine Valley in Belgium in order to be called lambic. So it's spontaneously fermented, which means you have an added yeast. It comes from the air. And there are only a few producers that still do this. Jean Van Rooy is descendant. It's a multiple generation family brewery. And it is a lambic that has been aged in Vin Jean barrels. Now, I didn't know what Vin Jean was prior to this trip. And Jean explained it. And I did a little bit of research in the back, after we left. But it's a young Swiss wine that's made, I believe, in the Jura Mountains. But it has a very distinctive spice note in it. When I tasted it, I thought there was curry in it. And I actually asked him, "Did you add spice to this? Because brewers add spice." He said, "No, that's from the barrels." And I looked when we were in Brussels to try and find us some of the wine. It's hard to find. New Orleans, however, being the place that it is, when I got back to the States, I called a couple of my distributors and said, "Do you have any Vin Jean?" Probably 6 or 7 producers of it. And I did find a Vin Jean. I sent the note to Cantillon, to Jean, said, "Is this the type of wine?" He said, "Absolutely, that's it. That's a good one." And I tasted it, and it was amazing to me. And I think I gave you all taste of the wine, too. How much of the flavor of that wine, now he didn't blend it with the wine. He just aged it in the same barrels, came out in the lambic that we tasted in Brussels. He and a couple of others in the industry, Armand with Driefontein, have really been credited in the last 20 years with reviving this historical beer making process and introducing it to brewers because it was on its deathbed 20 years ago.
And why was that, you think, Polly?
There's a lot of debate about that, but America 20 years ago was firmly entrenched in sort of the Bud Miller Coors culture. American beer geekery, as we know it now, was in its infancy. Jean and Armand with Driefontein, which is another brewery we visited just in a little city right outside of Brussels, both credited the American market for saving not only their establishments, but for saving the entire culture of lambic. It was the demand in the United States that started to grow that gave them the ability to continue.
That's so wonderful, particularly when you're talking about multi-generational businesses. Describe some of these breweries. I mean, how old were some of these places you all visited?
Yeah, Cantillon is over 100 years old.
One of the things that we found so unique, not only that each brewery was different, sort of each brewer's take on how they brew or what was most important to them was different. So like at De La Seine, which while his machinery was all very brand new, he's very dedicated to yeast. Right. Yeast is incredibly important in ale making.
He gives the most sensual brewery tour you ever want to go on.
How does that go?
Well, yeast is a woman, so it's about keeping her happy and letting her expand the way
because
she would like to.
Because when she is unhappy, she produces nasty things.
It's a wonderful tale that he tells about something that could come off very technical to someone, and he humanizes it.
Now that you all have been on the ultimate work field trip, how have you brought that experience back to the pub? And how are you seeing things differently and maybe sharing with your customers the differences?
One of the kinds of lambics that are very popular is a creek, which is a cherry lambic. It's a lambic blended with cherry juice. And two different brewers are in the process of making their own cherry farm because these cherry trees are not, first of all, the beer, they can't even keep up with the demand for that, much less growing enough cherries to juice enough cherries to make all the beer that they want.
The trees used to be very common backyard trees. And as progress, if you want to call it, has eliminated a lot of those backyard trees, there's no place to get them. In fact, Armand and then Aud Biersel both told us that they are in the process of planting trees to ensure that the next generation and the generation after that are going to have access to this native fruit. And I think that's the thing that brings a lot of what's special about Belgian beer home to me, because there's this generational aspect and the idea that you would plant orchards to ensure the longevity of your craft. Because those trees aren't going to bear fruit probably for another 7 or 8 years at least, and they're not going to be fully productive for many years after that. There's a very good chance Armand will, he'll be gone by then. A big part of what's enjoyable about this kind of trip is sort of soaking up the culture and seeing the way the way beer sort of just flows through the natural life in the cafes and the restaurants over there. So you could go to Belgium and have an extraordinary beer-centric trip and really only visit a couple of breweries and still come back with an amazing experience.
Ay, Marieke, Marieke, je t'aimais tant. Entre les tours de Bruges et Gand.
Polly Watts and her team from the Avenue Pub.
Entre les tours de Bruges et Gand.
When we come back from a short break, we'll have the extraordinary treat of a lesson in beer tasting from the one and only Polly Watts. Stay tuned.
Mon plateau mon Flandre, mon land, Marieke, Marieke, le ciel flamand, pesait-il torrent de Bruges à Gand. Marieke, Marieke.
Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and by French Market Coffee. Every premium blend of French Market Coffee contains a richness that can only be called New Orleans bold. Made from the finest beans, slow roasted in small batches, only one coffee captures the bold flavor of our one-of-a-kind city. French Market Coffee. New Orleans bold.
The thing that a lot of people who are not incredibly familiar with beer find surprising when they first start drinking beer is what a broad range of flavor profiles you have. If they're coming from a wine background, they're used to two major flavor profiles, white and red, and there are variances in between that, and then of course you got the dessert wines, sauternes and things. But for the most part, it's white or red, right? Beer styles are much, much more divergent. The difference between a sour beer and a hoppy beer and a barley wine are dramatically different. So it's not unusual for people, especially as they're just learning about beer, to discover that they really love one or two styles, but they don't necessarily, there are a bunch that they don't necessarily love.
When it comes to craft beer, Polly Watts is a treasure trove of knowledge. As the proprietor of the Avenue Pub, she's personally responsible for having overhauled the bar's beer choices, going from pedestrian mass-produced brews to a truly international craft beer selection. Since then, business has boomed, and Polly never looked back. That's why she was the perfect person to further my beer education. You see, even though I've toured some of the most exclusive French champagne caves, my beer tastes have been pretty much limited to a cold Miller High Life on the fishing boat. That's why, on a brutally humid afternoon, I tucked into the Avenue Pub, pulled up a bar stool, and let Polly take it from there.
We give menu descriptions and we tell people things they could look for as a guide for, are you going to like it before you order it? Our beers are too expensive to give out free samples of, so we don't do that. Every person's palate is completely different, and women's are dramatically different than men. They taste different things in the same beer. So I'm always hesitant to tell people what they should taste, because in the long run, it doesn't matter what the piece of paper says or what I say. It's whether or not, did you enjoy drinking it? And you can put all kinds of wacky descriptors on something, but it comes down to, when I finish that glass, did I enjoy that experience or did I not? That said, Evil Twin, Little B, is a Danish gypsy brewer who is now brewing out of one or more breweries in Connecticut. It's an imperial porter. I would say that it's creamy chocolate, the malts are roasted, and has vanilla fudge and a faint dark fruit presence.
I taste all those things. I love, 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 I have to admit, it's the beer for drinking and not necessarily for just knocking back crawfish with. This is just something that it's like dessert to me. It really is.
Well, it's almost as strong as many wines. It's 11.2% ABV. So if you drank a wine bottle of that, you would feel like you had just drunk a bottle of wine.
As Polly talked to me about the different types of glasses she uses to serve beer, I cupped the brandy snifter she'd given me in the palm of my hand. As the Evil Twin continued to warm, its chocolate flavor brightened with a fruity subtlety I could taste on the tip of my tongue. I could have stuck with that one for a while, but with all the beers for tasting, lingering on just one was out of the question.
Okay, is there an order that one should taste beers in?
There is not an order one should taste beers in. There is an order in which one should not taste beers in. So hoppy beers, which you probably have heard of, are called IPAs. Hops are palate killers in large quantities. And there are times where I actually put on the menu please do not make this your first beer. This needs to be your last beer. Because once you drink this, you will not be able to taste anything else. Sort of like hot sauce and food. You know how when you buy those five alarm chicken wings and your mouth tastes nothing for the next 4 hours?
Yeah.
Hoppy beers are somewhat like that. And if you read some of the names that brewers assign to them, Green Flash does a double IPA, which is more hops and more hops, that they actually call palate wrecker. Stone does a IPA, which they're very famous for, that's called Ruination. And it's named that because it ruins your palate. So if you're going to drink something other than hops during a drinking session when you come to the pub or at home, you don't want to start with hops. You want that to finish your tasting because you won't taste the nuances, either good or bad, if you blow your palate with hops early on. IPA is India Pale Ale. Within the IPA range, there are different types of IPAs. And whether they're West Coast, Belgian, English, or East Coast, sort of the four main ones. And that has to do with what kind of yeast is used. If a Belgian yeast was used, it's typically a Belgian IPA. English IPAs, and they originated the style, are done with different hops as a general rule than American IPAs. Well, Americans took the form and they amped it up and put it on steroids. They use very piney, resiny. I mean, there are some IPAs that it's like chewing on a pine tree at times. And people love that. West Coast IPA tends to go more towards the piney and citrus. East Coast IPAs tend to go more towards floral. English IPAs tend to be more balanced. And all these varietals are organic. So when you hear words like Simcoe, Centennial, Galaxy, Mount Hood, all the different hop varietals, those are a plant, in case people don't know. The hop is the flower. And the particular variety of plant, just like you would have a particular variety of mushroom that would taste completely different, depending on whether it's a, you know, an oyster mushroom or a morel, hops are the same way. They have different amounts of bitterness, different amounts of other flavors. Galaxy hops has a lot of blackberry in it, so you get that blackberry note when you use a lot of Galaxy. And they flavor a beer differently. There are IPAs, like Palate Wrecker, that are like a sledgehammer to the senses. This is still an IPA, but it's completely different. It's a West Coast IPA, which means it employs primarily piney and citrus hops, with a very low yeast presence. So you don't really taste the yeast. The yeast isn't part of the flavor profile in this kind of beer in the way that it would be in an English and Belgian IPA.
In all honesty, the West Coast IPA didn't do it for me. It had a beautiful aroma, but the flavor packed a punch that startled my taste buds. It was a bit like going from the kiddie pool to suddenly being thrown in the deep end. When Polly saw the expression on my face, I apologetically explained that usually wine is my game. With a smile, she pulled out a corked bottle that looked like it could have come from the Loire Valley. She peeled back the foil wrapper, popped the cork, and poured me a glass.
This beer is spontaneously fermented, but then it is aged in wine barrels, except that those wine barrels are about the size of this room. They're massive. Literally, you can crawl inside of them. The other thing that's kind of interesting is that you tend to think of beer as being made in a batch, right? And then you pour, you know, you'd extract that batch and put it into a keg or a bottle. Sour beers like lambics and gooses are blended. So the brewing process takes place and then they get aged. And then the blender, and that's as much a part of the art as the brewing, will go to each one of the barrels, and it's a traditional wine barrel size, and they will taste each one of them and decide, I'm going to blend A with B with C to get the perfect flavor profile. And that's where the flavor profiles come. So when you hear in terms of lambics and gooses, a big, big part of the flavor profile has to do with palate of the man or woman who blended it. And that is a dying art. Your palate has to be perfect. And there aren't that many people in the world that can do it. And I'll tell you something else that helps a lot of people who understand wine much better than I do. There's a movement within wine called the biodynamic movement, there's a movement within beer that's biodynamic. They don't use the words biodynamic, but that beer that you have in front of you is made by one of very, very few traditional Belgian brewers that uses what's called spontaneous fermentation. You know, the modern brewing method is that you add yeast, you inoculate a beer, and the yeast strain that you use determines a great deal of the flavor profile. The traditional sour beers from Belgium in the Seine Valley are all spontaneously fermented, the way you see some wines and champagnes in the biodynamic movement. It's all locally harvested fruits. If they're going to use a fruit in the beer, no sugar added, no sulfites, no stabilizers, all handmade. Every bit of yeast that kickstarts that fermentation, on which the fermentation builds, comes from the air. So there's this old story. Cantillon is the best known sour brewer in the world. There was this old story that Jean Van Roy had a couch in his open fermentation room, and it was old and it was very nasty, and his wife wanted to replace it. And he was afraid that if he got rid of the couch that his beer would not taste as good. Because it's the bugs that are coming from, you know, the rafters and the couch, you know, all in the air, that give it that flavor profile. So they're brewing in a building that they've been brewing in for 100 years. So it's 100 years of that sort of yeast development. I mean, if the building burned down, literally, the beer could no longer exist. I think part of what I liked about learning about craft beer, and it's educated me on learning about other spirits, is that yeast is a big part of the taste profile that we like or don't like. And as beer drinkers, we're used to talking about that. It's also a huge factor in whiskey, in bourbon. And most people don't even think of the yeast strain as being an important part of why they may like Maker's Mark versus Four Roses versus something out of the Jim Beam or Buffalo Trace Sazerac collections. And a lot of it has to do with that underlying yeast strain. So if you get to the point where you can kind of taste things and think, okay, well, I like that yeast strain and I don't like that, then that opens up a whole lot of other possibilities in terms of trying things and knowing ahead of time whether or not you're going to like them or not.
Now let's review. Porters and stouts are served warmer than you'd expect. Save your IPAs till the end of the evening, and try a Goose Lambic if you're a wine lover like me. You can give them all a try at the Avenue Pub in New Orleans or a craft beer bar in your neighborhood. I'm Poppy Tooker, and this is Louisiana Eats.
Down at the corner beer joint, I dance to the rock and roll. Sister likes to do it, Lord, sister likes to move her soul. Down at the corner beer joint, dancing on a hardwood floor. Oh, well, the jeans fit a little bit tighter than they did before.
Every year, Brooklyn Brewery hosts a road show called the Brooklyn Mash, a festival of food, beer, and the arts. Stopping in cities across the globe, including New Orleans, the MASH seeks to celebrate local communities and culture, showcasing the city's musicians, comedians, writers, and chefs. Traveling with the MASH tour is Brooklyn Brewery's head of culinary programming, Andrew Gerson, who began working at the brewery in 2013, the same year the MASH was launched. Andrew had barely gotten his feet wet when we interviewed him that April, but his enthusiasm then was palpable.
I have dreamt about doing these things. It's a dream job. I'm kind of dynamic. I get very bored. I don't like to be stagnant. And this is a job that provides an integrity, a company that I could work for and feel proud of being a part of their vision. Steve Hindy wrote this book, Beer School. I was in tears. I mean, it's a passionate story full of this energy, and it's an entrepreneurial spirit. It's different people coming together, all playing a role to build. I mean, we've quadrupled our size in the last 4 years.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And it's a family. I mean, I've been accepted into a, an office in this environment, and after a month given the support to go out on the road and live the way I want to, meeting new people and cooking and doing all these things with this structure, behind me that's so supportive in every aspect.
Right. 3 years later, Louisiana Eats had a chance to catch up with Andrew, who's as thrilled about his job at Brooklyn Brewery as he was when we first met. He discussed his MASH experiences and shared his observations on the growing influence of craft beer throughout the world.
In looking back retrospectively over the last few years, I think we've had a really strong evolution in what the MASH is. You know, we've had an amazing team putting together this. I mean, I remember our first interview sitting with Meg. Meg Stemmler sort of created this concept about really capturing what Brooklyn Brewery is all about, what we've done in our community over the last 30 years, or 27 years at this point. And now it's so amazing to be here 3 years later working with those same partners and this slew of other folks that make that community. And through those connections that we've made over the last 3 years, I mean, going into this third year here, it's really strong.
Andrew, I want to know about the international Andrew. Where have you gone with Brooklyn Brewery?
Our second largest market is Sweden. So New York for us, you know, and hopefully will remain so, knocking on this table here, our biggest market. And it's amazing to have that strength in your home market. And we're in 27 states around the country. But our overseas growth is fantastic. I think we're probably the largest export craft brewery in the country right now. And I think as the states gets more saturated and there's such good breweries everywhere, there's this really unique opportunity overseas. And there's amazing things happening there. So to be able to expand the MASH from just a national tour to Stockholm, to London, they're just really fun cities.
You all have actually, you're building a brewery.
Brewery is built and celebrated its 1 year anniversary.
Ooh,
not
in Stockholm.
Too long ago. Our restaurant is launched there. Chef Billy White is just phenomenal. He's a British expat who's been in Stockholm now for 8 years. That's sort of normal story. You're like, why? How are you all you chefs here from all over the country? Met a pretty Swedish girl. That was that. So
there you go. I understand how that goes.
So we've grown incredibly internationally. I think Brooklyn, the idea of Brooklyn and what's happening in New York, I think is very popular right now, but it's also about creating really good, you know, it's about the liquid in the bottle, and we have amazing beers, amazing quality beers. So we've been so well received from, you know, Japan, Brazil, Amsterdam, all over Holland. France is a huge market for us. Hopefully, you know, Paris MASH is not too far down the road. It's wonderful to be embraced. And what I think is so interesting is this is the first time in U.S. beverage or culinary history where America is really influencing what's happening in Europe. You know, you look at the wine culture that's developed in the United States, you've looked at most cuisine has such strong either European or other influences through immigration. But craft beer in America is influencing what's on not only menus, but what's being brewed across Europe, even in Belgium, in Germany, in Britain, which are some of like three of the strongest beer cultures in the world. And they're brewing American style IPAs and American ambers and American pale ales and American lagers. And that's like a real disruption the way that our culinary and food cultures have developed.
It's another beer revolution.
It's really cool. It kind of validates in a way that is interesting. Seeing craft beer culture in Vietnam evolve, they have a fresh beer culture. They don't have the infrastructure for draft systems, for instance. So you see these beer hoys, these like beer garden type spaces, and they get fresh beer delivered twice a day. So that there is a very strong, I don't even know if you can call it craft beer community, but a beer community all throughout Asia. That's pretty amazing. And what's so exciting to me now at the brewery is this barrel aging program that we've developed. We're working with Molly Browning, a really talented brewer, worked at a few other breweries specializing in barrel aging, and I'm really excited to start collaborating with her and doing some chef brews where we're talking about a smoked pineapple and ginger beer with the base of our local one and some really exciting things. So it's looking, you know, it's seeing what's happening all over the country and gaining inspiration in the same way with our cooking and what we've been doing.
Gerson, head of culinary programming at Brooklyn Brewery.
Yes, wine is fine, but give me lots of beer.
Now that we've learned about the craft beer scene from Europe and Asia, what's going on with beer in Russia? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets and by Cafe B, featuring contemporary Creole cuisine with an emphasis on fresh Gulf seafood, served in a charming yet unpretentious old Metairie setting. Lunch, dinner, Sunday brunch, and private events on Metairie Road. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. What's the craft beer scene like in Russia? Undoubtedly, when you think of Russia, you think of vodka. In fact, there's an old Russian saying, beer without vodka is like throwing money into the wind. According to the latest data from the World Health Organization, 51% of alcohol consumed in Russia are spirits, and only 38% are beer. This vodka culture has had deadly consequences for Russian men, whose average life expectancy of just 64 years lags behind that in European countries, due mainly to heavy drinking and tobacco use. But Russia's millennials are changing all of that today. They're drinking craft beer, not to get drunk, but instead for the taste. Since the summer of 2014, at least 24 craft beer bars have opened in Moscow alone. Many of these self-described gypsy brewers are now trying to resurrect Russia's brewing traditions. Originally, microbreweries were typically using imported American hops and German malt. But now, there's a movement towards local flavors, like Salden's Pyrenic Ale, which is meant to mimic a traditional fruit cookie, or experimental brews that use birch sap, buckwheat, or kvass, a fermented bread drink. Hops make all the difference in the flavor of beer, so to the rescue comes the Republic of Chuvashia. Chuvashia, the capital city of the republic, is the place where, for centuries, Russian Christian traditions have been defied. Still today, locals there conduct colorful pagan rituals and follow a pantheon of gods. The Republic is also one of the world's oldest beer-producing regions, with a tradition of harvesting hops and drinking beer as part of their religious worship. But during the economic downturn of the 1980s, the fields of hops declined from 35,000 acres to just 200 today. Luckily, the Chuvash Hop Institute was created to protect, preserve, and promote their region's unique and flavorful hops, which lend unusual flavors like citrus and blackberry to beer. The Chuvash hops are referred to as green gold, and beer brewed with them is so special. It's often presented as a gift at weddings and important occasions, including Saren, a pagan holiday on which evil spirits are expelled with barrels of alcohol and wild dancing. I hope someone invites me. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats.
Welcome to my brewery. My name is Scott Wood. I'm the owner and head brewer of the Courtyard Brewery in New Orleans, Louisiana.
I first met Scott Wood in a French Quarter courtyard where one of the inaugural Brooklyn Mash events was taking place. That day, two Brooklyn candy makers were making candy from, what else? Beer. Scott struck up a conversation with me, and as he stood there with his newborn son sleeping strapped to his chest, he shared his dream of opening a small brewing operation in New Orleans. It's always a treat to get to see someone's dream become a reality. Scott, how did the dream begin, and how did you get here?
It goes back a few generations. My great-grandfather owned a brewery and was a brewmaster in Montana, pre-Prohibition. Post-Prohibition, he moved to Los Angeles, and my family moved down to San Diego after that. My brother got into the beer industry in the early 90s, before the big craft boom, and then dragged me into the thing. I didn't drink until I was 30, so it was never really an interest of mine. I think I had smelled a Budweiser a long, long time ago, and it just made me retch when I was a really young kid, and that always stuck with me. And so I actually tasted my first beer at DBA on Frenchman. I remember vividly, it was a Rogue Dead guy. Little Freddie King was playing. And it was like, I was like, this is cool. This is never going to happen again. Then it was just like downhill from there.
Why did you call your brewery Courtyard Brewery?
Well, when I first moved to New Orleans, I lived in the French Quarter. I found a place in the French Quarter off St. Louis. And my good friend and I, we became good friends because of brewing, home brewing, and we would be brewing in the courtyard. It was a really great time for me because we would be in the middle of the French Quarter brewing beer and just kind of hanging out. And eventually it got to the point where I was brewing 3 or 4 times a week. So I would make the beer and somebody else was a pastry chef, so that she would make, you know, desserts, and our other friends would cook, and it was just this like communal neighborly thing. So when I was trying to figure out a name for the brewery, I kept coming back to Courtyard because it was a joke. It was kind of a joke at first. We used to call it the Courtyard Brewery because we would be sitting in the courtyard brewing. And it was never really anything more serious than that until, you know, we go to make an LLC and then it's like, oh, we need a name.
Well, and I guess then you also felt compelled to find a place with a courtyard.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big part of it. We had looked at like 30 or 40 places around the city and had an extensive search. I mean, that was a year and a half process just to find the right place. And then it took us 13 months from the day I signed my lease until we opened our doors. The bulk of that was waiting for safety and permits. Going from homebrewing to professional brewing, nerve-wracking, can't encapsulate how terrible it was and terrifying it was. So for the first... For the first like 3 months, I don't think we had any of our own beer because we just kept blaming it on equipment failure. But really, we were dumping batches because things just weren't working right. They weren't coming out right. We were scorching wort. We were under hopping things or just dumping beer everywhere on accident. Like, but we were still making money because we were able to carry guest draft. And so our ability to carry other breweries' beers, which is sort of an anomaly in the industry, really saved us.
So the day you open up here, you're not serving your own beer.
No, it was a Thursday in October in 2014. And we, you know, people came in and they heard there's a brewery opening up. And we had to quickly explain to them, look, yes, we're going to be a brewery. We are brewing beer, but we need to make money because it took us 13 months to get open. We're out of money. I think when we opened, we had 13 draft lines. Now we have 34. But all of 13 were carrying guest beer when we opened.
Are there very many breweries that have brew pubs where you can drink the competition?
Around the country, not really, because a lot of the laws prohibit it. For instance, Nola Brewing cannot tap guest beer. Their license disallows it.
Tell me, you get your own beer on tap, and what's the reaction that people have when you start presenting your own beer?
I think the first beer that we finally nailed down was our baby IPA. And I mean, I knew what it I knew what it was supposed to taste like because I've been brewing it at home for years. And getting that beer to scale up was extremely important to me. It was brewed in honor of my son, Jules, first of all. So that, you know, I mean, that alone means you got to get this right. We tasted it in the Bright and it was like, okay, I think we finally figured it out. And it was exciting. And a bunch of our friends came in and they were tasting it. And, you know, our friends are discerning, let's just say. So it passed the friend test. And that was the biggest hurdle for me. Once we got past all of our beer nerd friends, then I was like, okay, we know what we're doing now.
So how many beers are you up to now?
Last year, we made 50 unique beers. And this year, we're on track to making about the same. One of the great things about this model is that we don't have to churn out the same thing every day. So if something doesn't work for us, we don't ever have to brew it again. We don't have to go through the licensing process. We don't have to go through, you know, make packaging for it before we get feedback. We can just put it right on tap and see if it works. And if it does, we can brew it again, make it better, or brew the same thing. And if it doesn't, that's okay.
What's the percentage of seasonal?
I don't really brew to season, which is also unique. We kind of brew what we feel like drinking. We're really not beholden to any of that. I mean, we just brewed an Imperial Stout with donuts. We did a beer with District Donuts down on Magazine. And it's going to be like a 12 or 13% Imperial Stout with donuts. We brewed that right after we brewed a beer for Dan over at Stein's. And that was a 3.5% like hoppy blonde. So it's the middle of summer and we're brewing Imperial Stout like because we feel like it.
How many different beers do you have of yours usually available? And what's your run like?
We have 3-barrel batches, so roughly 90-something gallons of beer per batch, which is tiny. On tap at any time, we have 8 to 12. That's usually about where we land. We try to get as much on as we can, but it goes very quickly. And the guest draft takes pressure off our house taps. So if we didn't, I mean, we still need guest draft to kind of like buffer people just drinking us dry. But yeah, I mean, 8 to 12 is what we normally have based on cooler space and production capacity and all that. We're really kind of bursting at the seams.
Scott Wood of Courtyard Brewing. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Join us next week when we talk with cookbook author Melina Hammer about the importance of providing children a broad food repertoire as early as possible.
If we have a crappy food experience, unlike relationships, we won't go back. We won't say, sure, I'll try it. We'll say, I hate such and such. So it's really nice to give them an opportunity to know what it can be.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, French Market Coffee, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, by Dickie Brennan's Bourbon House, from oysters to redfish, serving fresh Gulf seafood on Bourbon Street, also home to the city's largest American whiskey and bourbon collection, and by Toujac's Restaurant, home of America's oldest stand-up bar, now celebrating 160 years on Decatur Street. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eats studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. I'm Poppy Tooker. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.